You're listening to the Unlocking Africa podcast.
I'm a medical doctor by training and first started working in East Africa about 13 years ago in a small part of Western Kenya.
Over the past few years, we've produced comprehensive reports taking deeper looks at the ecosystem of supply chain innovations that are technology enabled.
In many of these health systems, the same pharmacist is actually working in the public and private sector. And so they're usually using tools and resources in the private sector that they also want to be able to adopt in the public health system.
What we predict over the next few years will be increased collaboration, really, as companies look to work with each other better and merge with others as well.
Stay tuned as we bring you inspiring people who are unlocking Africa's economic potential. You're listening to the Unlocking Africa podcast with your host, Tessa Adamu.
Welcome to the Unlocking Africa podcast, where we find inspirational people who are doing inspirational things to unlock Africa's economic potential. Today, we have Yomi Kazim from Salient Advisory, which is a healthcare consulting company that tracks innovations in African health tech. And we also have Jessica Vernon, CEO and founder of Maisha Meds, which is a company that has created the first and largest network of private pharmacies and clinics in East Africa. Welcome to the podcast, Yomi and Jessica. How are you?
Doing good. Thank you very much for having us.
Yeah. Just wanted to echo that. Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure. I usually like to start from the beginning, so I'll go with you first, Jessica. Tell us a bit more about Jessica Vernon.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. It's very exciting to speak with you. My background is medicine and economics. I'm a medical doctor by training and first started working in East Africa about 13 years ago at this point, in a small part of Western Kenya. Started seeing how pharmacies supported the public health system by supporting patients to access care when there were stockouts in the public health system, and became really interested in that problem. And I've spent about the past 6 years building a company to solve that. So I'm very excited to share more.
Fantastic. And Yomi?
So I'm Yomi Kazim. I'm an engagement manager at Salient Advisory. And essentially, Salient is a healthcare consulting firm. We focus on helping global stakeholders and changemakers better understand the biggest trends in African health technology ecosystems by producing intelligence and then also convening partnerships. And so my work essentially lies in a segment of producing intelligence. I lead our work to produce and deliver market intelligence on an ongoing annual basis. And over the past few years, we've produced comprehensive reports, essentially taking deeper looks at the ecosystem of supply chain innovations that are technology enabled and are supporting both private, of course, and more importantly, public health supply chains as well, essentially to deliver a future, both a present and a future, I should say, where medicines and health products are more easily accessible, are more safely accessible, and also more conveniently accessible. The ultimate bottom line here essentially is that these innovations, like Jessica's Maisha Meds, are creating a present and future where regular Africans, our family members, our friends, our loved ones, have safer access to health products. And, you know, it's hard to overstate the impact of what that means.
Thank you for that, Yomi. So, Jessica, in your introduction, you gave us a brief background into your medical background and also an overview of Maisha Meds. So I was hoping you could go into a bit more detail regarding Maisha Meds in terms of the company, the work that you're currently doing in East Africa.
Sure. And we work in East Africa, but we also have expanded to both Nigeria and Zambia in recent years. So we started out with this question around how to best support private pharmacies and clinics to help them build their business. So we started off with business management tools based on the feedback from pharmacies to say, you know, how can we help them better understand their sales, profitability, manage their inventory better, and do this in an offline digital first way. That would help them meet them where they were at that last mile. A few years ago, then we started thinking about what we actually wanted to do to support patient care. And as we were digging in on the data on how pharmacies were supporting patients, we're finding that there were very clear instances where patients were accessing care based on what they could afford rather than what they needed. They were paying almost entirely out of pocket for their primary healthcare. And as a result, they weren't purchasing things like malaria rapid tests, longer acting emergency contraceptives, the right sort of non-communicable disease care. And so we started thinking about how we could kind of do small financial nudges to help them access the care they actually needed. So started with malaria testing before treatment. If you bring the cost of the test down, you can actually make sure that patients are accessing testing before treatment on a much more significant scale. So about 300% increase in uptake. And this has proven true for other disease areas as well. So over the last couple of years, we've received scale funding to support. Currently, we're at 2,800 pharmacies and clinics across the region. The goal in next year is to support about 5,000. And in the next several years, grow to about 10,000 pharmacies and clinics. We have funding to support over 1 million patients with this way of accessing care. And the goal is to make this just standard of care across the region.
Fantastic. So you've kind of detailed the work that you do in terms of supporting private pharmacies and clinics. And we know that salient advisory works, well, consulting and tracking innovations in African health tech. So people might be wondering, what is the link between the two companies? So can you elaborate in terms of how the two organizations have come together and are working together?
Sure. Essentially, as I said earlier on, our focus is on tracking leading innovators in this space that are leveraging technology to ensure that our supply chains of health products are more efficient. And consistently over the past few years, MyShemez has featured strongly in that work because, as Jessica says, there's such a strong player in that space. 2,800 pharmacies already. It's one of the largest networks that we're aware of, if not the largest. And so, you know, our work really is first presenting intelligence that highlights the broad work that's ongoing and then going further to spotlight some of the standout leading innovators to ensure that they, you know, essentially get access to a network of donors, of investors, of stakeholders that essentially have the power to make the decisions that could power their skill. So essentially think of us as producers of intelligence, you know, at the first level, and then at the secondary level, advocates of innovators in the space. Looking beyond MyShemez, our work in the most recent report highlighted the fact that on the Pan-African basis or on the Pan-African level, there are nearly 350 innovators that are digitizing health supply chains across the continent, spread across 27 countries in Africa. Of course, there's a high concentration in key markets like Nigeria, Kenya, Egypt, and South Africa. And that essentially mirrors what you see when you do broader macro analysis of health technology ecosystems, or rather technology ecosystems across the continent. So it's not that much of a surprise. But, you know, it's super interesting to see that there's nearly 350 companies out there doing great work to ensure that health supply chains eventually become safer, more efficient, and faster. And MyShemez stand out strongly as one of the leading ones.
Really quickly, the one thing I would add on that is when we first started out, private sector was not seen as an area that public health could invest in and focus on. And I think Salient has done an incredible job of building private sector healthcare as a category that is of interest to governments, global health funders, and others as a way to reach patients where they are and to ensure that there's kind of interesting debates about how to improve access and funding through private sector. So I've just been incredibly impressed with Salient's work over the last few years.
Brilliant. So, Yami, you've mentioned that your work is presenting intelligence. So what is the motivation to focus on the innovations in health product distribution in Africa, particularly concerning governments?
Well, as Jessica just said, the reality is a few years ago, the private sector wasn't seen as a potential or even strong enough partner. And so our work focusing on this segment of health technology ecosystems was essentially to do two things. First, to meet a demand from stakeholders out there who saw the need rightfully to understand this space much better than they already did. And this was initially triggered about 5 years ago when we did the first iteration of this work. And then we slowly built on that, producing about 4 reports in the past 5 to 6 years, all focused in different ways on this space and incrementally building on the awareness and advancing understanding of these stakeholders' outlook of the space. And on the other hand, it also is rooted in our strong passion to meet this demand wherever it is, but also build on that to essentially advanced global conversations about leading health innovators on the continent. The hypothesis is that there are so many exciting new models that are out there that are looking to do things in a much different way that has been done across the continent historically. The private sector, as far as health is concerned, has typically been, I want to say, overlooked or seen as monodirectional. But as we see this exciting wave of technology startups across the continent, across various sectors, there isn't as much as a focus on health as there should be. Of course, a lot of great, amazing things are happening in sectors like financial services, sectors like education, but also in health. We see new models springing up, and it's our job to ensure that the intelligence that helps people understand these new models are out there. And also it's our job to continue to advocate for these new models as well. And one of the ways to highlight how we go one step further in our advocacy is 2 years ago, when we produced the third iteration of this work, one of our recommendations was essentially to say that, you know, we see gaps in funding. African led innovators, and then also as well, women-led innovators seem to be on the lower spectrum as far as funding is concerned, as far as the flow of venture capital, equity, grants, and debt funding is concerned. And if that reality was allowed to persist, then we could have a situation where these innovators are essentially not as funded as they should be, resulting in a widening chasm in these ecosystems. And so building on that recommendation, we advocated to global donors, a global industry, essentially to design a program that allows them to create targeted grants that provide these innovators with the funding that they require. But then one step further, to attempt to catalyze their skill by looking to accelerate partnerships between them and governments, between them and key industry players, between them and donors. And that recommendation and that program design eventually evolved into what is today known as the Investing in Innovation Program, which is essentially a program that over the past 2 years has invested in 60 outstanding supply chain startups across the continent, all doing great work, providing them with risk-tolerant grant funding on one hand, but then more importantly, also facilitating access to markets for them by convening donors at the highest of levels, regional, national, and also, of course, global industry players at the highest of levels, and also government actors as well, bringing them in the same room with these innovators, having partnerships meeting with them over an accelerated period of 2 to 3 days in select countries, and essentially just, you know, having them speak with each other, engage with each other, and proverbially sow the seeds of potential partnerships. It's a work that we're really, really excited about. And it's just that highlights the link that exists between our work to produce intelligence and our work to advocate for the largest companies in this space.
Fantastic. So you shared a specific example with regards to, or highlights the successful impact of government partnerships with health tech platforms in Africa. With regards to that, in terms of this partnership, there are some challenges that might be faced. One of the challenges is the supply chain. So if we could be more specific with regards to what challenges do you think are faced by African health supply chains prior to the advent of these digital solutions and partnerships?
Well, the challenges are pretty well documented, actually. So essentially, it's been an ongoing reality where public health supply chains are typically overburdened. And we saw that most recently and most significantly during the pandemic, where essentially there were gaps and there were lags in getting important PPE materials, important health products across to points of need. And so historically, public health supply chains across the continent have typically been overburdened, essentially not being able to serve the entire capacity of demand that exists, as it were. Now, private health supply chains have also long existed in parallel with public health supply chains. The problem, however, is that those have also been fragmented. And so essentially what exists is you have this multiple layers across the supply chain between the point where medicines are imported or manufactured, and then the point where they are dispensed to the end consumer. The network effect of having so many layers in the supply chain is that as products pass through these several layers, first, it drives an increase in price. There's research out there to suggest that it can drive prices up by as much as 60%. That, of course, has an impact on equity and affordability. If prices are increasingly added onto with markups, etc., as products pass across the supply chain, it means that at the end of the day, a low-income earner in a certain part of Nigeria or Kenya, for example, is likely unable to afford that medicine as they typically should. Another effect, of course, is the impact it has on availability. Again, so much fragmentation across the supply chain means that at a retail pharmacy where a drug should be available and where somebody has got a critical need and needs to access that, you know, a medicine or health product, it probably might not be available. And then the third is that it also has an impact on quality as well. One of the well-documented problems with African health supply chains is the fact that there's, I don't want to say influx, but the stark reality is there's quite an abundance of fake and substandard medicines, right? According to WHO, across the continent, I believe the average is way above the 10% global average in terms of, you know, the availability of fake and substandard health products. And so what we are seeing is this emergent crop essentially of tech-enabled innovations like MyShaMeds, like the nearly 350 innovators that we also referenced in that report, that are leveraging technology to do a bunch of things, essentially ensure that there's more direct access to health products, you know, by the end user, via pharmacies, via clinics, via hospitals, as it were, ensuring that there's more convenient access as well via, say, online pharmacies that allow individuals to simply go on their mobile phones or their computers or internet-connected devices, find and order medicines that they need at critical points of need and receive them at a more accelerated pace than, you know, compared to previous years. And there are also technologies out there that are essentially building solutions to protect and track the movement of products across supply chains. And when you put all of this together, you know, as I said earlier on, we then have a reality where these innovations are working hand in hand, sometimes in collaboration, you know, other times in isolation, but collectively working hand in hand to build both a present and a future where these supply chains that have typically been overburdened, that have typically been fragmented, essentially become better optimized, become more efficient, resulting in a reality where that low-income earner in Kenya or in Nigeria or in Uganda has faster access to purchase medicines when they need them, a greater level of availability of medicines at their local pharmacies, at their local hospitals or clinics, and also, unknown to those residents, also a greater assurance of the quality of those medicines. Because when you have digital infrastructure that connects a pharmacy, for example, directly to a manufacturer of a medicine or an accredited distributor of that medicine, it essentially reduces the chances of, you know, fake and substandard products making their way into health supply chains and the flow of products across those supply chains. It's an amazing reality to be on the front foot of observing and on the front foot of building research and sharing with the world.
Yeah. So maybe we can take this in a different direction. So you mentioned direct and faster access. I know the report mentions that government partnerships have led to the democratization of digital orders. So how has this democratization positively influenced healthcare access, specifically in rural areas?
I can speak to this. So we actually work with governments in several countries. And in Kenya in particular, we spend a lot of time with the county government. So in Kenya, because of devolution in how healthcare is financed, the counties are actually the primary entity that is thinking about healthcare and budgeting for healthcare. And then they're working with the central government to then be doing some of their procurement and planning. So we work with several counties at this point that use our platform for managing all their stock at the last mile in their health centers and dispensaries. So they are able to log in at a central level and be able to see in every facility that they have, how much they have in stock, what is expiring, what is low in stock, what do they need to reorder. And one of the things that we found really interesting as we've been starting to expand this further is that the groups that are interested in this are actually the governors and the politicians within each county, not necessarily like it's also of interest to the groups that are within the Ministry of Health, but the groups really advocating for it are the governors' groups because they keep hearing from the constituents that there's no medicine in stock. And so if they're able to add that layer of accountability and understanding about, you know, when is that happening and why is it happening, they're able to then help influence and change those systems. So it's been a really powerful learning for us. And then I think the second learning is that in many of these health systems, the same pharmacist is actually working in the public and private sector. And so they're usually using tools and resources in the private sector that they also want to be able to adopt in the public health system. And so being able to give them those same tools and ways of being more efficient is actually a huge opportunity and a huge way of kind of introducing innovation within the health system.
Thank you for that, Jessica. So if we go back to you, Yomi, I know from reading the report, there's a section in it that discusses a decline in terms of new entrants from 2021 through to 2022. From your perspective, what factors do you think contributed to this decline, and how do you think it would kind of impact or change the future landscape of healthcare supply chain innovation in Africa?
Right. So I think the important context to say here before talking about the decline is the boom that we first saw. That boom came across 2020. In iterations of our research that have happened post-2020, we've consistently seen that there was a spike in 2020 driven by the pandemic. That's the big obvious reason. A spike in terms of the number of digital health innovations that essentially were founded or came into the market in that year. And so 2020 has constantly stood out as the year in which the highest number of new innovations entered the market, right? So if you look at the line chart, for example, what you should envision is essentially a line that's close to the bottom of the lower axis, that's almost flat with it from the 90s, starts to pick up in the mid-2010s, super high spike in 2020, and then a sort of a dip afterwards. And so, that context, that background for why that spike happens, which is the pandemic, is really useful information, because essentially what it highlights and what it suggests is the reality that after the pandemic, what we're seeing is this steep decline in the number of new market entrants that are coming into the space. And I think that, it follows logic, really, to start with, that during the pandemic, a lot of innovators were inspired to launch these solutions, seeing very clearly and starkly the crisis of need that existed, not just with supply chain innovations, I should say, with, also innovations that enable greater access to consultations, for example, greater access to diagnostics, possibly even remotely at home, beyond supply chains. This spike was also noted across other sectors as well. And so post the pandemic, what we are seeing could be due to a lot of different reasons. First, it could be the fact that there is a saturation of companies providing similar solutions, given the fact that a significant number of them came into the market around the same time. And now, while the market is broad as it is, there's still a saturation of companies that are similarly looking to do the same things. The second could be the fact that during the pandemic, we saw a super high demand for digital-first products, that is, products that enabled remote access. But after the pandemic, that has likely declined as well as far as that need for digital-first products goes. There's sort of like a reversion to the mean where it's not to say that there is no longer demand for digital-first products. It's that, people can leave their houses now. And so that need, that stark need for digital-only products has sort of reduced. And in most cases, it's now a balance. And then also as well, another factor that we're seeing is that in some cases, incumbents in this space are now adapting to provide consumers with services that are essentially similar to what the startups offer. And a great example here are traditional pharmacies and online pharmacies. And so in 2020, we saw a spike in the number of online pharmacies that came into the market. An online pharmacy, to define it very simply, essentially is a digital channel, an online channel that allows individuals to purchase medicines online, right? Order it online and have it delivered right to your doorstep, versus a traditional pharmacy, which is a physical outlet where you have to walk to, look through the shelves, pick up a medicine, and then, take that home and use it. But what we're seeing is that a number of the major traditional retail chain pharmacies that have existed on the continent, some for multiple decades, are now adapting to new market realities, building digital channels on top, of course, of their traditional retail chains, essentially to offer services that are similar to what an online pharmacy would provide. And so it's possible that a player who's considering getting into the space with an online pharmacy solution, for example, that isn't that much different from what currently exists. First, sees the fact that there's a saturation of several other online pharmacies. And then more importantly, sees as well these large incumbents that are pretty likely much better capitalized, also have greater brand name and brand recall, adapted to provide a similar service. And that could be seen now as a deterrent or a deterring factor. And this doesn't apply just, on continents. We, in our report, we cited that this is a trend or a phenomenon that we're seeing in other markets as well. In the US, companies like CVS and Walgreens, they're looking to replicate features offered by digital-first nimble innovators as well. So it's a combination of several of these factors. Now, what we predict over the next few years could be increased collaboration, really, as companies essentially look to work with each other better, partner with each other. In some cases, you know, some better funded companies or better growth companies could look to acquire and merge with others as well. So it's an interesting time to look to what the effects really of this slowdown could be. The slowdown itself isn't necessarily a bad thing. It doesn't mean that we're not seeing innovation still happening in the space. There's still a lot of innovation happening in the space. It's just one of the, I'd say, characteristics really of the evolution of an ecosystem that's still in its early days.
Yes.
The more interesting periods definitely still lie ahead of us.
Yes. So rightly so, you mentioned that there was a boom in 2020 due to the pandemic, decline 2021 to 2022. We're coming to the end of 2023. So what does 2023 look like from your perspective with regards to the number of new entrants in the space?
So as far as numbers go, since 2020, 2021 and 2022, we've seen nearly a 90% drop as far as new innovations that come into the space are concerned. This year, as far as our research goes, so we completed our research towards the first quarter or early second quarter of the year. So it will be inaccurate to speak to the entirety of the whole year. As we continue to do this research in coming years, perhaps we can, you know, be better positioned to reflect on 2020 as a whole and provide any information. I just want to say, you know, to anybody who's out there listening to this, you know, don't take the wrong message from this. It's not to say that you shouldn't launch your innovation because we're seeing this slowdown. If anything, now is probably the time to launch your innovation, especially if you can differentiate yourself appropriately in the market space.
Yeah, I think the one thing that I would add on that is the macroeconomic environment, the increase in interest rates has just affected the startup ecosystem globally in many, many ways. And I think this is just also a reflection of that. I think that many of the larger groups that have raised quite a bit of money at very high valuations are having trouble exiting now or thinking through kind of what the next step is for them. And I think that there is going to be adjustment as a result of that. I think the next phase of people entering the market in 2024 and beyond, everybody from investors down to the innovators themselves are going to be much more careful with how to think about fundraising to make sure they're not pricing themselves out of a potential exit for this. And so hopefully there's going to be more partnership on how to do that thoughtfully.
Thank you for that, Jessica. So if we stick on the theme of the innovators that are in the space, we know from the report that many innovators are focused on data analytics within the healthcare supply chain. So from your perspective and from the work that you're doing, Jessica, how do you feel these analytics contribute to improving the efficiency and effectiveness of supply chain processes?
Yeah, great question. And we've been very lucky within our team to have the person building our healthcare analytics work be the person who built IQVIA's business in East Africa. So he has years of experience building healthcare. IQVIA is one of the largest healthcare analytics companies globally. And so he's kind of taken some of that knowledge and then applied it to how we are providing our offerings and thinking about building them. I mean, there's just a dearth of supply chain analytics and understanding more generally. And so I think a lot of the work that we're seeing now is just learning more about the sector, learning what products are actually selling, what the price points are, what the margins are, and being able to have that very detailed information to help do planning for the future. There is definitely an interest in forecasting, but I think the forecasting is still very focused on public sector and using those public sector supply chains. I think the stronger interest right now is actually in thinking about new product launches and thinking through what products should be introduced and registered in individual countries based on what else is doing well in those countries. And so a great example is our analytics team has just finished some work looking at emergency contraceptives and actually showing the kind of a global group of people focused on emergency contraceptives that they had underestimated the total market size across Africa by, I forget the number, it's like 100x or 1000x, something just kind of absurdly large. And so as a result, it's changed their strategy in terms of how they're thinking about re-registering emergency contraceptives as a periquital method, so before or after sex, and thinking through kind of guidelines changes within the WHO. So I think those are the highest yield instances we've seen. But I think there's also just the ability to have that visibility at the last mile unlocks all sorts of decision-making power throughout the supply chain.
Thank you for that, Jessica. So if we stick on the theme of the data and the analytics, I know there is generally a challenge in terms of collecting reliable, usable, timely data on the continent. So how have you guys gone about navigating that challenge of collecting the data, ensuring that it is usable and to enable with your processes as an organization?
Yeah, so we've built it into every part of our operation. The point of sale platform that we've developed that's in 2,800 pharmacies and clinics currently captures information on every single sale in terms of including the pricing, the brand, the, you know, how much is in stock and who the supplier was. And we're able to use that to provide really interesting specific trends on the last mile. We found that it's most powerful when it's paired with additional information on market level intelligence. So you need to also, you know, in order to understand what's happening in a particular town, and in order to make it especially useful, you have to understand how much that particular town or that particular pharmacy's information is representative of something happening at a larger scale. So we've needed to also build capabilities and data sets around like market level information, and it's by pairing those two that we find the most value.
So I'm assuming to enable you to do your work, partnerships and networks are key. So are there any notable partnerships that you have engaged in that have enabled you to do some of the great work that you're currently doing?
Yeah, wonderful question. I would say governments are the first one. We've been just so impressed by partnerships we built with the National Malaria Control Programs in several countries, by the HIV and AIDS programs in those countries as well. And how thoughtful many people within the Ministry of Health are and how to engage private sector and how much that's becoming a core part of what they're thinking about. We have really incredible partners within the global health space. So working with the Gates Foundation, USAID Development Innovation Ventures, and others to think about how to scale these technologies. And there's a lot of things that are operating at a very early stage, but they've helped us think through what national level scale looks like and helped us to have that ambition, which has been really neat to see. And then finally, you know, as we think about scaling, the goal is to work through partners that already have networks. So wholesalers, pharmaceutical associations, governments and others too. And, you know, NGOs sometimes also have very strong networks. So leverage their capabilities to both be able to expand our data capabilities and network, but then feed that data back to them to help them be better at what they do has been a really important learning as well.
Brilliant. So you mentioned that governments are key partners. So I guess with governments leading the way in partnerships, do you think, are there any notable hurdles that might be faced trying to scale these public sector or government type partnerships?
The main one we're encountering all the time right now is just the fiscal position of many of these governments. It's been an especially hard couple of years with currency depreciations, and a lot of them are just working with a lot less money than they had a couple of years ago. And so they're trying to figure out how to do more with less. And oftentimes the things that get cut first or the things that don't get budget first are the ones that are new or novel and haven't been proven yet. And so I think they're struggling to figure out how to amply resource these sorts of things and make sure that they're thinking for the future as well. So that's been the primary one for us.
Earlier on, Jessica, you mentioned that you have a presence in quite a number of African countries or markets. So are there any specific countries where you've seen government partnerships have had significant effect in terms of transforming health supply chains?
Yes. So we have core operations in Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, and Nigeria. And in three of those countries, we have actually started working directly with the government on their malaria programs, and have been really impressed by how data-driven and thoughtful they all are in how to build these programs for private sector. But I think the standout for me is Uganda. The National Malaria Control Program there is starting to face resistance to many of its anti-malarials, or the primary anti-malarial that's used across the region, to the rapid test that's commonly available, and then also to the bed nets. So it's a tough time and tough set of problems to be thinking about. And they've just been doing it with this very thoughtful, very data-driven way of, you know, targeting specific interventions to certain regions, doing a lot of experimentation, and kind of meeting the partners where they are in terms of what they're able to offer for some of these solutions. So I've learned an incredible amount just watching them in action. And I've been very impressed.
So from the Uganda example, which is a great example, what lessons do you think other African governments can learn from this positive example?
I think the first one is many governments try to always resource public sector first because there is a shortage of resources in general. Like there's not enough to go around. And so they try to put the funds and put the focus on the things that they're most able to control. But I think that by being able to use a small amount of additional funding that is effectively just leverage to run experimental programs and think about how to influence private sector, you have the ability to actually instead of incremental improvements in health systems, like exponential at that stage. They're just at a different point in their investment life cycle. And so things like capturing data and then influencing behavior in private sector, many of these groups are actually paying for antimalarials to be distributed via private sector, but focusing in on resistance. I think that, yeah, that's been one of the biggest learnings that I think can be applied elsewhere, is that willingness to engage with areas where there might be more impact to be had with smaller amounts of money.
Fantastic. Thank you for that, Jessica. So Yomi, I guess back to you in terms of the insight that you gather and collect in the reports that you generate. If we look at the innovation within Africa, we know that there are some key markets where we are seeing huge numbers of innovators in, say, tech startups, primarily Nigeria, Kenya, South Africa, and Egypt. Are you seeing a higher concentration of innovation in the healthcare supply chain space in those markets, or is the a decentralization we're seeing innovation spread across the continent?
Right now, it's more of the former. It's a concentration in key markets. Nigeria, South Africa, Kenya, Egypt account for about 60% of all of the innovations that we tracked across the continent. In total, we had identified innovations in about 27 African countries in total. But 60% of them, as I say, are concentrated in just these four markets. One of the segments that often tends to get overlooked or, perhaps under-discussed is Francophone Africa. And we also have some data and insights on that as well. So 12% of the companies that we track are headquartered in Francophone African markets. So think markets like Cote d'Ivoire, Cameroon, yes, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Senegal as well. About 90% in total of all these companies that we track are headquartered on the continent. But then we've got about 10% that are headquartered outside of the continent, but of course maintain operations within Africa. So these companies are headquartered around North America, around Europe, and around Asia. One thing that's interesting to note and mention, though, is what we're seeing in terms of companies operating in more than one country. So MyShamaze is a fantastic example of a company that's been able to, start from one market, test that model, solidify that model, and then expand to other markets. As Jessica said, they now operate not just in Kenya, but also in Nigeria and Uganda as well. But that's just not yet commonplace, which is something to expect with an ecosystem that still is nascent, right? So around 80% of all the companies that we track essentially still operates in a single country. And as I said, operating in more than one country essentially is currently limited by the fact that the ecosystem is still nascent. A lot of the companies that we track in this ecosystem are still nascent. But another key thing to point out as well is a limitation as far as multi-country regulatory environments are. In some cases, these environments are uncertain. For some of these models, regulatory guidelines don't yet exist. So it makes expansion somewhat of a tricky subject. So the reality is the majority of these companies are probably not yet positioned to expand, but as they increasingly grow and get ready to, it'd be useful for governments to also start, I think, in advance about updating or adapting their regulatory environment to essentially foster more innovation that allows some of these companies to grow within their countries or come into their countries with expansion from other markets where they already operate.
Thank you for that. So Jessica, Yomi mentioned the challenges faced by startups or innovators in terms of expanding to new African markets. So from your experience, you operate in a number of African markets. What have been the challenges that you faced trying to expand into new markets?
So first of all, I think for many companies, it's wise to be fully focused on one market. I think the thing that has enabled us or pushed us to be expanding to many is that much of our core business is data analytics focused. And until we are building reimbursement programs for patients, it's actually very light touch and just tech enabled. And so we have the ability to adapt the tech to many different contexts without having to, support warehouses or other things that many of these other innovators are focused on. So wanting to have information about as many markets as possible at as large of a scale as possible, and then wanting to kind of think through what are the common pieces of functionality has been the reason that we've pushed into many of these different markets. In terms of challenges, I mean, it's many. I think the biggest learning is just when you add a country, each time it's going to get easier and it almost feels like it gets harder, or it's equally hard each time because there's just many compliance, regulatory, finance-related things that are just challenging to do. And the costs don't necessarily scale in the way that you think they will. So oftentimes you have to build the same components in new markets. I would say the second piece is just making sure we're really understanding each local market. You kind of assume that they're similar, but actually they're quite different in their needs and in the competitive landscape in many places. And so there's been a lot of product changes that are needed when we enter particular new countries. And then I think the other challenge is just thinking through what the right kind of regional approach is and how to build a team that feels integrated across these countries instead of feeling like they're silos and that each individual team is building their own culture.
Thank you for that. So what role do you say government policy plays in terms of encouraging innovation and also expansion?
I mean, it can play both sides. Sometimes it encourages and sometimes it discourages. I think in terms of encouragement, the more there are streamlined policies around how innovators can expand, and there's encouragement from individuals within governments that are inviting people or enthusiastic about particular things that are what really drives that push forward in terms of expansion. In order to start in a new region or a new country, there's often just this very long checklist of things that must be complied with. And so I think being able to streamline some of that and maybe make it easier for innovators to kind of move through those processes would be an important step towards encouraging further expansion.
Thank you for that, Jessica. So Yomi, in light of your findings in terms of your report, what policy recommendations would you make to governments to further promote and sustain these digital innovations in health supply chains?
That's a great question. And the question I was also asked very recently. It was at the Global Health Supply Chain Conference. On a panel that featured, you know, global donors, also government officials from the host country of Kenya. And I said at the time, which is an answer I'll share again, that I really do think it's a simple equation as far as a policy recommendation for countries goes. For countries that want to see more innovation in not just health product distribution, but also health innovation broadly, for countries that want to see more innovation, one simple but big step they've got to take is creating regulatory environments that allow those innovations to thrive. First to emerge and then second to thrive. So, you know, to my mind, it's a pretty simple equation. For countries that are intentional about creating these regulatory environments, over the next decades to come, they will reap significant benefits. Because the reality is, while of course, you know, taking care of health is one of the government's key jobs as far as creating infrastructure is concerned, there's a thriving private sector as well as far as providing healthcare is concerned. And the abundance of innovators that are doing the work to create the solutions that ensure that healthcare access is more reliable, is safer, that access to health products is more efficient, more reliable, is also safer as well. The abundance of those innovations that exist can only ever be a good thing. And, you know, one example that I share is, a few years ago, when unmanned aerial vehicles essentially were first prototyped as a potential tool to distribute medicines on the continent, there was some pushback from some quarters, while in other quarters, there was, you know, a bit of an embracing of this new technology. And so in certain countries on the continent, these innovations were allowed to essentially test their models, allowed to fine-tune these models, and then allowed to launch these models on a larger scale. And in markets where these innovations were embraced or accepted, we now see that there's a much larger uptake as far as leveraging drones to deliver medicines is concerned. Whereas in markets where there wasn't that initial embrace, where there was perhaps a bit of trepidation, those markets essentially are now playing catch up. And so that dynamic is essentially the equation that exists to my mind. Countries that want to see more innovation first have to create the regulatory environments that allow these innovations to emerge and then to thrive. The more innovations emerge and thrive, the more access people in those countries are likely to have. And more significantly, the more innovations that emerge and thrive, the more potential partners the government has to work with to optimize public health systems, to optimize public health supply chains, and ultimately to advance public health outcomes.
Fantastic. I like that. So creating an environment to allow innovators to emerge and thrive also creates resilience. Could you share some best practices or trends that you're potentially seeing?
Absolutely. So one of the best examples really is to think about online pharmacies as a market segment. In our work, we identify online pharmacies as one of the most common types of models out there in operation. In the market segment that we classify as direct distribution to consumers, there are nearly 200 innovators in there, with the majority of them essentially that individuals can essentially purchase medicines directly from them. So, you know, that's essentially an online pharmacy model in a snapshot. Now, the reality is, even though these are the most common types of models out there, across the continent, the majority of countries do not yet have regulatory guidelines or even established regulations to guide online pharmacy operations. What we currently have is a reality where a lot of these online pharmacies operating across markets on the continent are essentially operating in this weird gray area where there's no regulatory guideline to guide how they operate yet. In several countries, these discussions are currently ongoing in terms of, you know, creating this guideline. In a handful of countries, guidelines already exist. But the reality, as I say, is that irony where this is the most common model we're seeing, but across the continent, across the majority of countries, guidelines to regulate how this model operates don't currently exist. It's that classic case of regulation playing catch up to innovation. And so think of it as a low-hanging fruit, really. Of course, there are multiple ways to create, you know, enabling regulatory environments, but just looking at that segment of online pharmacies alone, it's urgent, really, for governments across the continent to think deeply and also to think more nimbly about approaching creating guidelines that allow online pharmacies or that to guide the operations of online pharmacies. You know, the argument from us is not allow every single online pharmacy that exists to, you know, to operate. The argument is create the guidelines that essentially guide how they operate to ensure that good faith actors can thrive and to ensure that bad faith actors do not. A great example of a best practice is what we're seeing in Ghana, where there's a national electronic e-pharmacy platform. Essentially, what they're doing or what they're looking to do, since this is fairly new and was launched earlier this year, is aim to centralize in one key national hub the operations of online pharmacies. And so the idea is this central hub that's operated by the government that allows them to have oversight as far as transactions with online pharmacies, between online pharmacies and the general public goes. And so they've got this high-level bird's eye view of all that's happening in there. Online pharmacies have to register with the government and can transact through this platform. And that does two things. It creates this safe medium through which members of the public can access health products and health services provided by these online pharmacies. And it also allows the government to maintain a keen eye on ensuring that these transactions essentially are fostering and advancing safety of the public, and that bad faith actors who potentially be selling fake medicines cannot operate at all in this space. It might not be an example that translates to every single country, but that's one approach that they're testing and taking right now. And we're super interested in seeing how, you know, that evolves in the coming years.
Thank you. So you've highlighted some key trends that you're seeing. So if we move from the current trends to the future, how would you foresee the future of healthcare supply chain innovation in Africa evolving over the coming years?
Well, I'm going to share a hopeful picture. The hope is, if we look to do this work in another decade, the hope is that first, for starters, we see a more Pan-African spread. In our work this year, we saw positively, you know, innovators across 27 countries. We would like to see that, you know, reflect a bit more the reality that there are 54 countries across the continent. In swaths of the continent, as far as regions are concerned, where there are noticeably white spots as far as, I wouldn't say missing innovation is concerned, because it could be that with our research and our landscaping, we miss some of these innovations. But I'll say we see more prominence in those regions. So Francophone Africa, Northern Africa, for example. Another thing we'd like to see as well is more equity in this ecosystem. Jessica is such a powerful voice in this space. And she's a model of a company or an innovation that's, you know, that led by a powerful woman founder. The reality, though, is across this ecosystem, we don't see yet enough equity as far as supporting women founders is concerned. Right now, as far as the landscape goes, what our data reflects is that women founders seemingly have a greater reliance on grants and debt compared to equity, suggesting that there is still a measure of a bias or gaps in terms of how equity funding flows into the space. Would love to see more equity, you know, along those lines. Another hopeful high point as well is seeing a lot more, not just a lot more partnerships between governments, but deeper partnerships with governments. Right now, the reality is a lot of the partnerships that exist, very exciting, very, very promising, but are still in the early days. I would like to see, you know, in a decade, for example, where these partnerships are ingrained to serve two purposes. The first is to ensure that on the one hand, for the innovators that have these partnerships, they constantly have a significant large public purchaser in the government. Having, you know, being able to serve large public purchasers is one pathway to scale for these innovators. And of course, the second is that governments can then translate the benefits of the models of these innovators to a wider and broader public, so ensure that, you know, the public benefits from positive, you know, impact and benefits that these, that the models of these innovators have to offer. So yeah, a more Pan-African spread, we're seeing innovations in more countries, more equity in the ecosystem, more support for women founders, and more and deeper government partnerships. That's my hopeful picture of the future.
Fantastic. That's a great picture and something I look forward to seeing happening. So Jessica, if we go back to yourself, where do you see Maisha Meds and yourself in 5 years' time? What impact or work will you be doing in Africa's healthcare space?
Great question. The name of the game for us right now is scale. So in 5 years, I would hope to see us in 10 to 20,000 health facilities across 5 to 6 countries in Africa and be supporting millions of patients every year to access like all of the areas of primary care that are most needed and least accessible right now. So the focus is on continuing to expand our product base with our reimbursement program, think through new health financing areas to help support that, and then to continue to scale the platform more generally.
Fantastic, fantastic. As we're coming towards the end of today's conversation, there's a question that I ask each and every guest that's a bit different to the rest of the questions.
Quote of the week.
As people, we often have quotes, mantras, proverbs, or affirmations that keep us going when times are challenging or when times are good. Yomi, do you have one that you can share with us today?
Wow, okay. This is a good chance to pretend to be deep. Okay, I'll take it. Now, I'll be honest. So I don't know that I have one single mantra. My mantras change over time. But one that has been on my mind over the past month or so essentially is life is what you make of it, right? And it applies both at a personal level, but also, of course, on a broader philosophical level as well. Essentially, we're seeing innovators across the continent that are operating sometimes in resource-constrained circumstances, in markets where data isn't exactly as available as they'd like, in realities where funding as well is not as available as they'd like, but yet they're pushing on, they're powering on, they're creating these models that could well define a future generation for Africans. Essentially, they're making the most of the circumstances that they have. It really strongly reflects the mantra that has been played on my mind over the past few weeks, which is life is exactly what you make of it. These innovators are inspiring. Jessica is one of the leading voices, of course, in this space. And it's great to be on the sidelines and also on the front lines, helping people understand better what you're doing, and then also, of course, advocating for them to continue doing the amazing work.
Very true. Jessica, do you have one that you can share with us today?
Yes. So the short answer is from Angela Duckworth, who's the writer on Grit, is enthusiasm is common, endurance is rare. But I think the takeaway for me is a lot of our biggest insights and greatest strengths as an organization now have come from some of the hardest times that we've had. And in many of those times, it's been this question of like, should we keep doing this? Because it is quite hard. And especially early on, you know, I'm so glad we're through that period, but I understand there's so many innovators out there who are wondering whether this is, you know, how they're going to spend the next 5 years, 10 years of their time. And I think it's in those moments when you're asking those questions and really drilling down to what's most important, that you get the greatest insights that you can then turn into the next phase of the business if you look deep within yourself and kind of have that reflection.
I like that. A very fitting quote for a startup founder. It is about obviously the early enthusiasm and also the endurance. So yeah, thank you for sharing that.
I think we can all agree that Jessica's is much deeper than mine.
But I also Googled it just now, so I just found one.
Brilliant. I like that. Brilliant. So as we come into the close of today's conversation, I was wondering if you had any closing remarks, final course of action for people who are interested in health supply chains in Africa and the great work that you're actually doing on the continent as well.
What we like to do is spotlight innovators. So I do think strongly that, you know, Jessica, who's right there in the front lines doing this amazing work, should have the last words.
Thank you, Yomi. And I guess the first thank you is just to Yomi and to you, Terser, for giving us this opportunity to shed a light on the supply chain work. I think it's really important that groups that are interested in healthcare in Africa first be thinking about how to do it more efficiently and thoughtfully, get in touch with innovators, maybe us, maybe others that are highlighted in the report, but just, you know, start to reach out and build that conversation and learn how to work together on it. And then I think the space just needs more people as well that have the talent and technology and product and in operations to keep expanding. I think the next phase is going to be incredibly exciting and excited to find people to head in that direction with us. So thank you.
Thank you for that, Jessica. And thank you, Yomi. It's clear that you're both doing great work, and this collaborative effort highlights the importance of the health supply chain aspect within Africa. And I'm looking forward to reading some more in-depth and detailed and valuable reports that come out from Salient, and also keeping a close eye on the progress and the great impact that you're making on the continent via Maisha Med, Jessica. So yeah, thank you for joining me on the podcast today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you to everyone who has listened and stayed tuned to the podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, share, or tell a friend about it. You can also rate, review us in Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcast. Thank you, and see you next week for the Unlocking Africa podcast.